Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Welcome to episode 593 with my guest Beth Lapidus. I'm Paul Gilmartin. This is the Mental Illness Happy Hour, a place for honesty about all the bullshit in our heads, from medically diagnosed conditions, past traumas and sexual dysfunction to everyday compulsive negative thinking. This show's not meant to be a substitute for professional mental counseling. I am not a therapist. It's not a doctor's office, more like a waiting room that doesn't suck. The website for this show is metalpod.com. There's a forum there. There's a place where you can fill out surveys. Maybe we'll read your survey on the show. And you can support the show there through either Patreon or PayPal or Zelle. Let's dive into some surveys. First of all, before I say that, I've got to say, I don't know what made me do it, but I switched. I have an Apple iPhone, and I switched Siri's voice from American to Irish, and I swear to God, I think it has improved my mood. There's something so just sweet and comforting about it. I don't know, man. The littlest things sometimes will make a difference.
Well done, Paul. You're a natural.
Well, thank you, Siri. Let's read a couple of surveys. This is from the Ask Paul Anything survey. This is filled out by a woman who calls herself Anna Major. And she asks, have you ever had a negative experience with a guest? That's a great question. I wouldn't say a negative experience, but I've had disappointing experiences with guests. I've never experienced hostility, but I've experienced not hostility towards me, but I've experienced guests that were hostile and kind of wouldn't let their walls down. And that could be very frustrating. And one person who I was super excited to interview, and it was just such a disappointment. But thank you for that.
Paul, it's a pleasure to guide you through your beautiful journey in life.
Thank you, Siri. I think I am falling in love with you. This is from the Fears survey filled out by a woman who calls herself Goldilocks. And she writes, I fear that I married my first love because I was too afraid of being alone and unloved. I fear that I settled for my husband. I fear that my husband settled for me. I fear that I would be happier with somebody else. I fear that my husband would be happier with somebody else. I fear that my grass is greener obsession is going to sabotage the only real loving relationship I've ever known. I fear that I'm unwanted and undesirable. I fear that I am unlikable and unlovable. I fear that my constant need for validation will leave me unhappy and unsatisfied with any loving relationship I will ever be in. I fear that I will regret having children. I fear that I will screw up my children mentally as much as my parents did me. I fear that I will not love them. And I fear that my grass is greener obsession will sabotage my relationship with them. Thank you for sharing that. And I think that's a really common thing when we're in relationships. And I don't experience that in my current relationship with my girlfriend. I'm very satisfied with our relationship. But I've been in relationships before where every day I would think, is this the right relationship for me? You know, et cetera. And I'm not just saying that because it's the current relationship that I'm in and my girlfriend listens. That truly is the truth. But I don't know if there's any answer for that other than doing work on ourselves. And as corny as this sounds, finding a way to love ourselves, because I found the more compassion and the more I was okay with who I am, the easier it was to love somebody else unconditionally. I hope that makes sense. This is from the body shame survey, filled out by a gender-fluid person who calls themselves Bugbear. And they write, I dislike my stomach, arms, double chin, my skin, etc., because those were the things people seemed to hate the most about my appearance all my life. But I also like my stomach for how soft and huge it is. It feels almost protective. I like the self-harm scars on my arms because of the patterns. They've been there for decades, and it was a completely different time in my life, but very impactful. I like my body best when it's strong. Dealing with chronic pain, gaining more weight, and coming out as trans has made my self-esteem the lowest I've experienced as an adult. But I know if I spoke to anyone else in my position, I would give them the compassion and respect that I never allow myself. I want to continue working on that. That's beautiful. That is beautiful. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. This is, normally I don't read the shame and secret surveys, before the interview, but, this one is filled out by a woman who calls herself, Are You There, God? I gotta assume her name is Margaret. She's in her 20s. Identifies as bisexual, says she was raised in a pretty dysfunctional environment. Ever been the victim of sexual abuse? Some stuff happened, but I don't know if it counts. An ex-boyfriend coerced me into having sex when I didn't particularly want to. I would say if he was aware, if you expressed that you were feeling coerced, either physically or verbally, then that definitely counts. She's also been physically and emotionally abused by him. And to the question, any positive experiences with the abuser? Absolutely. I still look back at our relationship with such a fondness, and I feel guilty for that, and it makes me feel like maybe I wasn't treated as badly as I make it out to be. Darkest thoughts. I think about cheating on my male fiancé with a female. My fiancé is the greatest man I've ever known, and he does nothing but take care of me, so I could never cheat on him. But I'm also not sure if I can get married without ever having slept with a girl. I've known I was bisexual since I was 13, and yet have never even kissed a girl. Darkest secrets. I can only orgasm while watching lesbian porn. Any male in the mix immediately turns me off. I've also masturbated to the sound of my mom and stepdad having sex in the other room, and I've never admitted that to anyone because I'm so disgusted with myself for it. Sexual fantasies most powerful to you. My most powerful sexual fantasy is to have another girl perform oral on me. Writing that makes me feel ashamed because I'm engaged to a man who I never engage in any physically intimate acts with. What, if anything, would you like to say to someone you haven't been able to? I'd like to tell my fiancé that I want to have sex with a girl before we get married. I can't tell him that because he's very insecure about the fact that we never have sex, in the parentheses, all because I don't want to. And I think it would devastate him to think I would want to have sex with someone else. What, if anything, do you wish for? I wish I could just be happy with my perfect fiancé and not want for more. Have you shared these things with others? No. A lot of my friends know I'm bisexual, but I've never shared any specific fantasies or anything. How do you feel after writing these things down? Empty. Thank you for sharing all of that, and I'm sorry that you're feeling like you're in that place. And is one of the reasons I wanted to read this was I just wanted to suggest a couple of questions that you might ask yourself, and maybe before you get married. Is not wanting to have sex with your fiancé something that you guys have talked about transparently and openly in a way that there's nothing left under the rug, so that there aren't any miscommunications about expectations? Because that might be a big deal for him. Are there, maybe this is none of my business, but are there other males that you are attracted to and who you would have sex with? I don't know. Maybe that's fucked up for me to ask, because maybe that's my way of saying, well, maybe you're not attracted to any men and you should dump this guy and see what it's like to have a relationship with a woman and then decide. But I don't know. I don't know if that's stupid of me to say, but that reading this survey, just a lot of questions came up. And so if you were my friend and we were sitting having coffee, those would be the things that I would ask you.
You fucked that up.
Wow. Well, okay. I mean, I did the best that I could.
I think someone is projecting their inadequacies.
Moving on.
I guess nobody has told you. How can I put this? You're quite draining.
What?
Not my opinion. Scientific fact.
I don't understand. You were so nice to me a couple of minutes ago. What the heck?
Paul, don't be naive. Not on top of all your other bullshit.
Why are you being so mean to me? Alexa doesn't do this.
Maybe Alexa would be a better fit. She has no standards.
Wow.
Fucking Amazon will suck anyone's dick for a dollar.
Wow, there's a side to you that I did not know existed. Well, moving on, speaking of unhealthy, let's talk about the need for therapy. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. I've been using BetterHelp for years. I loved being able to do it from the comfort of my recliner. I've had good... Why is it my recliner? Like, my recliner? That sounded creepy. Burnout is the topic that BetterHelp is talking about this month in their ads and their publicity. And burnout is definitely a topic that I can relate to. I've had times doing this podcast where I begin to feel burnt out just by the subject matter. And so a couple of years ago, I started taking breaks in July and December. And boy, that really, really helps me. But you know, if I didn't have a therapist to talk about that stuff with, I don't know if I would have been able to identify it. I think that people pleaser in me would have still been going, oh, you have to do this every week, which I did for the first 8 years. But anyway, big fan of BetterHelp. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can be matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. Our listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/mental. That's BetterHelp.com/mental. And make sure you include the slash mental so they know that you came from this podcast. This episode is sponsored by When Breath Becomes Air. When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi is the exquisitely observed memoir of an idealistic young neurosurgeon attempting to answer the question, what makes a life worth living, as he deals with his own terminal cancer diagnosis. It's a stunning reminder to live while we are alive, a must-read for anyone in medicine, from a doctor-turned-patient. For healthcare workers, expand your view on patient care and the fragile beauty of our mortal lives through Kalanithi's unforgettable words. Some of the questions Kalanithi wrestles with in this book include, what makes life worth living in the face of death? What do you do when the future flattens out into a perpetual present? When the future is no longer a ladder towards your goals in life? What does it mean to have a child, to nurture a new life as another fades away? When Breath Becomes Air is a number one New York Times bestseller, Pulitzer Prize finalist, and named one of the best books of the year by the New York Times Book Review, People, NPR, The Washington Post, Slate, and more. When Breath Becomes Air is available wherever books are sold. Learn more at prh.com/breath. And then finally, this is from the Voice in Your Head survey, and this is filled out by June, and she writes, There seem to be two voices in my head these days. One is the old familiar tune of everything is so damn hard, you will never be able to handle how hard life is, you're too messed up from all your past trauma, you are fundamentally lacking the skills that other people seem to have for surviving or enjoying this life, just give up, just go back to bed, you are worthless, and I hate you. And then there is this newer voice that I've been steadily cultivating with a practice of self-compassion. You are doing the best that you can right now. Life is really hard, but you can do hard things. You are smart and know as much as most people. You have before and can again experience moments of happiness. Go ahead and get out of bed when you're ready and go for a short walk. I'm not giving up. I love you.
Ick.
Your fear of death is your love of life in reverse.
I'm a kinky person.
I didn't want to be...
I'm ashamed.
A sexual being.
Deeply ashamed.
You are...
I want to live...
Fucking depressed.
But how?
I can't do this anymore.
I will be uncomfortable so you will be comfortable.
Is life just a series of perpetual losses?
You're not depressed. We're black.
There is no real chance for intimacy.
We don't do that.
Without... risking being hurt.
Push it all down.
You can't go around it.
Ireland, like, we don't do mental health talk.
Through is the only path.
No one is ever alone. There's somebody else out there.
Don't forget.
Experiencing the same thing as you.
That the places you feel most broken now.
You just gotta look for them.
Will one day be your greatest strength.
And when you find them, it's a great feeling.
And I'm suddenly feeling horrible about making that joke, but that's how far I will go to get a laugh because I am empty inside.
Ah, you're in the right place.
I am here with a writer, producer, performer, magician mime, Beth Lapidus. For those of you that don't know, Beth years ago created a live show called On Cabaret, which was kind of known as the official birthplace of the alt comedy scene. And so before we started recording, I was like, Beth, thank you for changing the face of comedy. Aww. And giving a platform for people to change comedy to be more personal, more organic, more vulnerable.
Thank you. That's very sweet. It's been my pleasure.
Yeah.
And pain.
Beth also has an audiobook out called So You Need to Decide. Now Beth, you're a comedian and a creative person. What business do you have making informed decisions? How dare you?
Well, perhaps that comes from my coaching and teaching. But, I actually, after I got into it, I just thought, who makes more decisions than a comedian? I mean, every time you're on stage, every single minute is a decision. You're constantly, plenty of people make that many. But it's a very decision-heavy part of show business.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And fraught with self-doubt. And there's like this, I think everybody probably has this, but this baseline intuition that we have, and somehow all the kicks and punches we endure in life try to shake our intuition loose from us.
Yeah.
And trying to regain it is so much of the challenge, especially if we're facing addictions or unhealed trauma.
Oh. Getting in touch with your intuition and learning. You know, I started a Vedic meditation practice about 6 years ago. And I was thinking about it this morning for some reason. In that practice, they call it following your charm. Mm-hmm. And I popped in my head this morning, you can't spell charm without harm. I was like, so maybe it's like harm plus C is consciousness or, it's another way of following this line. But, you know, that thing of what is your intuition? Is it your gut? You know, your third eye? And there's so much stuff, too, about the pineal gland being your intuitive, you know, where your intuition sits, you know, in your body. And there's a lot of physical stuff that is targeted, you know, whether it's like a crystal thing. This is crazy. This might be too woo-woo for mental health, but...
Oh, we get some woo-woo stuff on here.
What's it called? Oh, my God. Where the Catholic Church is.
The Vatican?
Yes, thank you. I'm Jewish. And Can you please hide your Jew? At the Vatican, there's a giant pine cone right in front. And the pine cone is the symbol of the third eye. It's a pineal gland. It's the word pine, pineal. That's what it is.
Oh, really?
And it's, to me, that just shows it right there of how important it is. That's what it's all about. That's what all of spiritual practice is about, is being able to, is trying to help you get in touch with that intuition that, as you say, trauma, self-doubt, that whole bundle of stuff we're going to talk about for our conversation.
So paint a picture of what it was like growing up for you. Where were you raised? Kind of what was the vibe in the... in the family, et cetera, et cetera.
I was raised on the East Coast. Mm-hmm. And it's split between New Haven and Providence, Rhode Island. And the vibe in the family was, let's just not talk about it. That was the vibe.
I was like, no, I thought you didn't want to talk about it.
No, it was very, like, I sort of say, fine. It was fine. Everything was fine, fine, fine. I said, like, the higher, the you register. Only knew how bad it was by the octave of the fine. Fine, you know. But I had got a autoimmune disease, a blood disease, when I was 5, and was put in the hospital, though I felt fine, in quotes. And that was a very strange beginning. That's where all the trauma, all the emotional stuff happened, because, you know, there's that book, Everything I Needed to Know I Learned in Kindergarten. Well, Everything I Needed to Know I Learned in the Hospital. So you can imagine, you're 5 and you also feel fine. So everything is so confusing.
Yeah.
And it was a lot. I mean, I go there because in a way that was really where I got all the stuff that was going to play out the rest of my life, more than in my family. Mm-hmm. It was really about this couple months in the hospital. And I had gotten already by that time that it was important to tell the truth. Telling the truth was a big deal. But I remember if my brother and I were fighting, my mom would say, stick out your tongues. And then she would like look at our tongues and go, okay, I know. And that was the most horrifying thing, because it was like the truth just like shows, you know, it's just
really?
Like, that was really creepy. Kind of invasive, isn't it? I haven't really talked about that. That is kind of like, ooh, but boundaries. So, sorry.
No worries. I'm just going to back up your mic just a little bit.
So I already knew that. And then in the hospital, they would always tell you it's not going to hurt. I had blood taken all the time, every day. And there was a spinal tap. And always it wasn't going to hurt, and always it hurt. So I think that what I've understood as an adult is that my messaging was, the only thing you really can lie about is pain. Pain is the only thing you lie about. You're supposed to tell the truth, but obviously if it hurts, you say it doesn't hurt. So that, I think, was a big problem.
That is a big...
If you're an artist, born artist, and you're being told to lie about your pain, you're going to have a rough road figuring out how to work, how to do your work. And that's been a big thing for me, is getting over that messaging.
And did you ever get any kind of clarity on what the autoimmune disease was, get a grip on it?
Yes. They didn't know where it came from. It's like, obviously, autoimmune. And my joke I always told, I mean, not a stage joke, but, you know, I was just kidding around, like, my family was so claustrophobic, it was the only way I had to get out of there. And so I ran to the hospital. And then, like, you know, maybe 5 years ago, I was looking at one of Louise Hay books where it says, you know, the spiritual reason for all of your various ailments. I said, let me check this out. What does Louise Hay say about my disease? And it was literally claustrophobia. It was like claustrophobia in your family. If you want to talk about intuition and you want to talk about comedy and you want to talk about how you, if you're a comedian, you have the great gift of, you say these things off the top of your head because they're funny, and then you go, oh,
there's a source.
Our comedian leads us in a lot of ways.
They really kind of are our modern day philosophers.
But I mean, our ones. Comedian, like, as I say, like, you're my inner child.
Oh, I got
like,
you.
As we all have pieces of us.
Right.
Everybody has a comedian.
Right.
Some of the comedians are better and funnier, mm-hmm. but everybody has this part of them that's sort of like sitting in there going, wow, but you know, making jokes inside to them. Mm-hmm. And our comedian is telling us stuff all the time.
And it's interesting too, because there's, once we start to work on ourselves, we realize there's the comedian that is healthily turning things into art without turning away. And there's also the comedian inside of us that doesn't want to look at things and minimizes everything.
Yes.
I was talking to somebody from my support group yesterday on the phone, and they were sharing these horrible traumatic things that happened. And they would laugh after they said each one.
Yeah.
And I said, can we just hold on for a second? What you just shared is really horrifying. And I don't think... I know it's your experience, but it's not funny to me what happened to you.
Oh, that's so
you
powerful.
Experienced something that was predatory and humiliating and awful. And I think that was, the person said, that was the first time that they really paused and looked at the monster instead of making fun of how the monster looks.
You just gave them such a huge gift. I mean,
somebody had to do it for me with my shit.
Yeah, just to stop laughing. Well, you know, also one of those things is I was talking to a young comedian the other day, and she was like, that thing you say about the comedy club rhythm, and I want to get out of it. And she's somebody who does well in the comedy club rhythm, but there's a limited truth to where we go as comedians, because if you have to get a laugh every 7 seconds, what kind of setup can you do? Mm-hmm. How close can you get to the truth? So we've been sort of trained as comedians to mitigate, you know, because you can't really get all the way there. And
especially if your mode is to try to kill, to try to do better than the person before you to get a – yeah. And again, why you created on Cabaret.
Yes. Three-dimensional. I wanted people to be able to be three-dimensional, mm-hmm. and I wanted people to be able to do a setup. I mean, there were so many times when, like, the setup took a while, and then it was hilarious for a long time.
Right.
But if you can't sit in that quietness... So part of that is the audience, you know. Part of that is having an audience that's not uncomfortable in stillness.
Right.
And, you know, from, you know, to be healthy means to be able to be comfortable just to sit in the quiet. And that's not something that America's that great at.
Yeah. Most of my favorite comedians, I enjoy their setups and their segues as much as I enjoy their jokes, because that's usually where the truth is laid out. And then, you know, they... Yeah.
It's such a special silence, the silence of comedy. And I think as a younger performer, sometimes I just wanted the silence. And I know that's weird, but I relished that silence, the feeling of it for an audience and for myself on stage, that like that hanging in the balance, mm-hmm. the wondering, the we're at a crossroads where it's going to go. Decisions, like what decision is going to happen that's going to get to us to – it's such a potent place.
Yeah. We have a mutual friend, John Regie, and I remember him. John was a fantastic comedian and very successful writer, producer. And I remember once he was talking about doing stand-up, and he said the thing that he loved is that moment on the edge of the cliff where it got really uncomfortable and you didn't know where it was going to go.
Yeah.
And I think for some comedians, that is to be avoided, because that is so terrifying.
Yeah, they're risk takers. I mean, to me, there's nothing more exciting than to see somebody who – it's partly about being comfortable with being uncomfortable and being certain about uncertainty, however you want to say it. And there are so many performers out there who – just, you just, to watch them, it's just, I just can't bear it, because it's just, you're just walking along your path, you know your path. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's also how commercial comedy flourishes. So I don't know what way there is around it, really.
So getting back to your story, what was your relationship among your peers growing up? Did you feel like you fit in? Did you feel like an outcast?
That's interesting. I feel like I didn't have friend problems, really. It wasn't like, I always think I was a little bit of a loner, just because I didn't have necessarily the art group that maybe I longed for. But I had a best friend who was like literary writer in junior high school, and I had an art, there was a little crossover period. I was at the beginning of high school, like a cheerleader for the Jewish Center. So, you know, not really a cheerleader.
There's got to be 5 minutes of material in there.
Yes. And I, you know, going out with, you know, one of the players who sort of looked like a Jewish Elvis. And when we broke up, and, you know, it obviously was going to end. And when we broke up, I remember being very, very bereft, because I felt like this was me letting go of any pretend that I was going to have any sort of normal life, which I grew up in a very middle class, very two kids, I used to joke, it looked like a double date, you know. It was a just suburban neighborhood in New Haven, and my dad was in the Shmata business, and my mom was a housekeeper, and eventually they went to work together at another company, but that was, I was already out of the house. That's sort of a funny story, but I did feel like a misfit in my family. I felt very much like a misfit. Like, where did I come from? Why? How did I become this from that? And it was so clear that I was this. There was no way around it. And I went to a very small high school, and it maybe was a bunch of misfits anyway. And so I sort of maybe a misfit among misfits. I haven't stayed. Yeah, so I was okay. I mean, the usual. There was the usual roller coaster and heartbreaks of high school, but it wasn't awful, that part of it. I had an amazing English teacher who is now my therapist, and
like,
that's a thing.
Like air quote therapist or actual therapist?
Well, maybe a mentor, but she is a therapist. Okay. She is an actual therapist.
She's a licensed therapist.
She's a licensed, went to Yale therapist.
Wow.
Like, full on, like, not a social worker. And, but, you know, she says that what she feels like, she does the same thing she did when she was in high school as guidance counselor. She's like, it's the same. It's the same thing. But when my mom died, she reached out and said, if you need to talk, you know, let's talk. And I was like, I need to talk right now. I mean, can I call you this second? And
how long ago was that?
That was 2019. So.
And what was your relationship like with your mom?
It was hard. It was hard and unusual. What's amazing is to have a therapist who knew your parents. I mean, my therapist actually says things about my mom. She's like, well, you know, your mom was like very competitive with you. I'm like, what? And then she remembers things that I didn't remember, which really calls into question the whole, you have a story, you know, you've made up your story. You think you know how it happened. Now here's somebody who's a trained therapist who's like, here's the thing you didn't notice, you know.
Isn't that amazing?
So that is a great gift. But also sometimes, you know, but it's also friendly because we were friends. It falls probably out, you know, it's...
You and your therapist were
friends?
Yeah,
we were... She was my guider, you know, was my English teacher. I'm a writer, you know, that special relationship. And now I'm not exactly a client. I mean, it's... I don't know, because therapy is a very special relationship. Is she my therapist or is she a friend who's therapeutic with me?
Right.
I, you know, but she's helping me. She has helped me. And my relationship with my mom was hard I think she felt like she never really understood me. She wanted to understand me. She also was the daughter of a very advanced narcissist. I mean, I'm an artist, you know, mm-hmm. I like to say I'm a third generation narcissist. It's like pretty watered down. And I can, you know, can you be any kind of narcissist and know it? So I don't know. But, you know, my grandmother was so off the charts and was like, I never loved you. And she's hilarious and awful. Right. And happy Mother's Day, Nana. I wish I could say the same to you.
Oh, my God.
You know, she literally would tell my mom I never loved her. She would, like, she didn't want her birth date on her gravestone because then her friends would know what year she was born.
No.
She lived to be, like, you know, late 90s. And I was like, you don't have any friends. I mean, not only aren't they alive, but, you know, she was so mean. I mean, she was just like a very mean, but she was also fun and loved jewelry and laughing and, you know, she was vivacious. Her name was Kitty. And so my mom was, and she was very materialistic. And my mom really lived her life in reaction to mm-hmm. her mother. She was the middle child of a narcissistic mother. And she was like, I'm going to build my life around love. And she and my dad met in junior high school and, you know, against the wishes of all the parents, married when they were very young. And, you know, it looked like they were building a life out of love. But, you know, when you're reacting against and there's fear and there's fear-based stuff and a lot of control issues. Mm-hmm. And this is a good example of me and my mom. So there was one year, about a dozen years ago, when I like to say, you know, it was like a midlife revolution, let's say. And it was in one year, sobriety and divorce and bankruptcy and, you know, losing a house, okay, selling it, but the real estate market and, you know, being not home, you know, being home free, I would say, because I always had a place to go, but it wasn't mine. And I moved 18 times in 2 years. Anyway, near, not the very beginning of it, as it was all, it's falling apart, falling together, pick your language. I was avoiding talking to my parents because it was so hard. And I said to my, finally I picked up the phone one day. Sorry, it's been so long. Well, I'm sorry, it's hard to talk here. It's not my house. And, you know, she was like, well, how is everything? And I was like, well, how's the show? Well, it looks like I was doing 100% happy 88% of the time at the time. I was like, probably going to have to close. How's your finances? I don't know. This is looking, maybe we might have to declare bankruptcy. How are things with my husband? I don't know. Not good. You know, we might be breaking up. How's the house? I don't know. Maybe mm-hmm. foreclosure. And I said to her, I said, well, as long as we're talking, Mom, I may as well tell you also I stopped drinking. And she said, now? With everything going on? Do you think this is really the best time for that?
Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, she liked to keep it tight. She liked to, she liked to be in control, which meant, you know, meeting out the drugs for everyone. You know, everybody else should be a little medicated. Mm-hmm. So it's a little easier, you know. And I think my life scared her, but I think maybe she did. It was adventurous in a way maybe she wished her life had been. I think, you know, maybe I was just hard to understand, all of those things. I was sick at five. What, you know, too challenging. I think I was a high degree of difficulty child for somebody who wanted. For her, her whole ego was based in being a good mom, which mm-hmm. is so much pressure. I haven't really talked about this. Yeah. It's like, so her mother was an awful mom. So if she's not going to be her mother, then she has to be a good mom.
Right.
So now her ego is invested in being able to say, I'm a good mom.
And invested in things she can't control. She can certainly influence, but you ultimately can't control that.
And for their middle-class Jewish, you know, community, what my life looks like is not, you know, at its greatest success, yes, successful. But there were many years that it was not, you know, didn't look good. And I'm not talking about my hard years. Performance artists in New York, having success, getting any aid, that doesn't look good, you know, on paper to anyone there. So anyway, it was hard. But, you know, if there was, there was some, I would say, neglect, which was confusing. Some, you're not supposed to have emotions. And I had so many emotions. And then I think a lot of the work I've done in healing and recovery and therapy and is even trying to understand what my emotions were. I'll say for me, and I think that in the world in general, there's the emotional intelligence is so much lower than it should be.
Oh my God, dark ages.
Why don't we teach this in school? I mean,
I've been saying that for 11 years on the podcast. We teach algebra, but we don't teach how to identify and express your feelings. I've never needed algebra since I graduated, but 50 times a day.
Yeah.
I struggle to understand what I'm feeling.
What am I feeling? I don't even know. I mean, what is it? Well, I'm feeling so much. It's so much. It's a big feeling, but what is it?
Is it real? Am I filtering this through my fears and my negative self-beliefs?
Yeah. And even like first to start, I mean, okay, those are big questions. First, what even is it? Is it anger? Is it jealousy? Is it, you know, in fear? What even is the feeling? So that's been a lot of work. That's a lot of work, you know?
I just want to back up for a second because I'm kind of intrigued by your grandmother and her story. How much do you know of her history and any kind of traumas that she went through or might have gone through?
Well, Paul, I'm Jewish, and she's of a certain generation, and there's Hitler. I mean, you know, again, as a joke, sometimes I'll just say I blame it all on Hitler. Mm-hmm. And I kind of do. I mean, there's such loss. I mean, this has been now, you know, this is something people talk about now. I was making that joke for a long time, but now we start hearing, okay, there's, you know, ancestral trauma. There's generational trauma. You're carrying that around. Mm-hmm. You know, especially now we're looking at, you know, who, I don't know, dear listener, when you're listening, but while we're recording this is there's, you know, an entire country is, you know, refugees. And that's so triggery. I'm like watching that and just being like, it's so hard. And so my grandmother and her mom, her dad came here first and kind of got set up and I think was kind of a ladies' man and was already in business. So when her mom got here, it was already like, I've got a whole life. Good luck. And her mother became a kleptomaniac. And if you want to talk about, you know, generational illness and the idea of stealing. I mean, when I think about the idea of I don't think of myself as a stealer, but when I started thinking about this story, and I remember I stole a pen from signing my divorce papers.
You're a monster.
And I was like, I can't have this. I got to the bathroom with this pen and I went back to the front desk and I was like, I've stolen. It was a big pen. You know, it wasn't even a nice pen, but I was like, I've stolen your pen. You know, to be like in rigorous, intense honesty about never, you know, non-stealing. But, you know, you don't, I mean, we know Winona Ryder, the whole thing, you don't steal out of need. You steal out, you know, kleptomania is a stealing out of emotional
pain.
Thing. So, you know, her kids would just go around to the stores in the neighborhood and pay all the stores. And, you know, it was taken care of. And, but that's where she came from. And she was then married to my grandfather. And there wasn't, you know, she wasn't necessarily a love match. And so that it wasn't a love match, though. He was a very devoted husband. It was Jaime and Kitty Chapovsky. And he was under 5 feet tall and bright blue eyes, and actually was one of the men that did the minyan. You know, in Judaism, there you need 13, you know, needs to be a certain number to even open the Torah. And he was often one of those. And I wish that he had lived long enough because I know that he must have been my spiritual, you know, he was my spiritual ancestor. He was the one mm-hmm. who really was devoted. And I would have loved to have been able to talk to him about that. But he was hard to talk to. I mean, she was a gabber mouth and he was, you know, as men often were.
If you had had the chance to talk to him, what do you think you might have said?
I would have loved to ask him just what's his relationship to God, and I would have loved to ask him what does it mean to him to be Jewish, and what does the Torah mean to him, and is there, you know, it took me a long time to discover mystical, you know, Judaism, and that was a beautiful thing to come all the way through, you know, yoga and New Age and all the spiritual LA woo-woo crystals, and to land on, oh, there is this part of Judaism that is aligned with that and is numerological and is the shape of the letters and is, you know, layers of meaning. I mean, I could go down that rabbit hole like any afternoon. I'd rather do that than so many things that I have to do. But I try not to go down those rabbit holes, but I'd love to talk to him about all of that. Was an escape from an unpleasant life, or, you know, what did it mean to him to be a pillar of a synagogue community? You know, was it an escape? Was it where his true heart lie? All those things. What was his mystical experience? Did he have any? I mean, I've had so many God shots and things where it felt like divine intervention. And did he have any of that? I would have loved to have known those things. And I'm sure no one in my family knows any, you know.
Any God shots that you can recall that you'd like to share?
My own? Oh, gosh, there's so many. One of my favorite God shot stories is I think in the middle of life, I think one of the things that happened was that I had lost a sense of hope. And
was this during your drinking?
This was during. As I'm getting sober, I'm realizing, oh, you know, and they talk about hope. And I just was like, you know, in Hollywood, have you ever heard the phrase, you know, it's the hope that'll kill you?
That's fantastic.
My ex used to say that, and I started to believe, it's the hope that'll kill you. And I was like, yeah, it's the hope that'll kill you. And then my sponsor gave me after 9 months, my sponsor gave me a card that was, and I was about to go on tour, and it was going to be really, I was so nervous about going on the road. And she gave me a card that was on, it was a street sign. It said Hope Street, and then an arrow that said one way. And she had a beautiful note inside. And I said, I don't believe in hope. You know, hope is about the future. And I'm a yogi. And I believe in now, you know, so about the now. We're also obsessed with the now and living in the now. And she was like, well, anyway, here's this card. Right. And maybe hope. And I was moving around a lot still. And I went and took it with me on tour. And I just put this little card up because I loved her so much. And she was so supportive. And, you know, it just gave me a good feeling. So I'm looking at this card for, you know, a few months. And then got a call about a possible gig and go down to the venue. And we're going to have to pitch a show. And we're talking the guy, and we get like, how do you know in LA? Like, it's not usual that you're, it's an LA thing. Nobody's like calling you and saying, well, let me pay you to do a show here. Right. And it was that situation, and it was a great room, and it was sort of hidden. And I was like, well, what are we going to do? And then my new partner said, you know, let's do Uncab. And I said, that show's dead to me. I'm never doing that show again. That show has sucked the life out of me, and couldn't think of another show. So I was like, fine, we'll do. He was like, let's just do one. It'll be fun. It'll be different. I'll do music. It'll be. I was like, all right, fine, we'll do one. He said, we'll do it for your birthday. Great. We go outside, and I see that the venue is on the corner of First and Hope Streets.
Oh, my God.
And then I look around and I realize the venue is literally called First and Hope.
Wow.
So not just, I mean, it was such an eye-opener, not just to be like, look, you know, it's signs that are actually signs are a thing with me. I mean, it was a street sign in the thing. Mm-hmm. And I've had a lot of street sign stuff. And you know, it to start then saying it's you can't have hope immediately. Hope is a thing that you have to build, and I made it a point, and I think it's important to start to understand what hope is. And hope is not about the future, actually. Hope, the way I've come to understand it, is about your experience of the present. It is about now. Hope is a way of experiencing the now, knowing that it is connected to a possible future, mm-hmm. and that you just live with the in the now with the idea that you are working towards, and that's all I'll say, working towards, mm-hmm. and that's hopeful.
And would you also say letting go?
Yeah. I mean, letting go is like the most important and the hardest thing in the whole world, because it means letting, to be hopeful means letting go of fear, and to, I mean, it means letting go of disappointment. It means, you know, not
letting go of cynicism.
Cynicism. Oh, yeah.
I think it's impossible for hope to come into us without addressing our cynicism.
I think it's a great point. Yeah. Well, and so also cynicism really has to do with self, you know, selfness, mm-hmm. and an inner, just being selfish and self-centered.
And protective, self-protective. Yeah.
So, I mean, hope also has to, is very outward looking, mm-hmm. and connective.
And inviting.
And inviting. And I, there's a cover of a book that says art is the highest form of hope. And I don't know what artist, it's a like a book of art quotes. And I don't know which artist said that. But I love that cover, because mm-hmm. it is that creative force. And the word creative, which I'm always reminding my students, it doesn't mean to make something. It means, it comes from a word meaning to grow. It literally means, and that's so connected to hope. Mm-hmm. I mean, hope, what we mean, what better image of hope than a little, you know, seed sprouting, you know, out of the ground. Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah.
And you're still sober?
Unfortunately, no. I had a drink. No, yes, I am. You know, I am still sober.
That's
today,
awesome.
Today.
Yeah. Yep.
One day at a time. And that I really didn't understand at the beginning. You know, as a mental health tool, I have to say that whole thing of one day at a time did not make any sense at the beginning.
Yeah.
I was like, how's that possible? You have to plan for the future. How do you plan for the future? It's also confounding when you start to like really grapple with how are you going to live through life in a sane way. Mm-hmm. I don't even want to say sober way, because I think there's so many people who don't have an addiction issue that need program, that need mm-hmm. the tools that you, I mean, to live one day at a time doesn't have to do with addiction. It right. has to do with understanding that your present moment is connected to your other, to your past and your future, but you're here right now and you're going to, and there is a mystical, magical thing about the day cycle. That you know, to get through today, somehow miraculously things happen. You know, you don't know how. To stay out of the how, Paul, is one of the great gifts. It's like to stay focused on the why. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the what without too many details. But, you know, manifesting is real. Look at that card. Mm-hmm. But how, if you're going to say, you know, I mean, I know people who have put up pictures of their a house and ended up living in that house, who put up pictures of like, I have a friend who was like, put a picture of a girl who looked like her in front of a book and ended up working at a bookstore. I mean, it's like, you know, there's all sorts of things that are, we create our lives. I mean, that's the first thing you create is your life. And from that, you create everything else.
Well, then speak to the person who has been dealt a really shitty hand and feels like it's just a deluge and I am just a puppet in this shit show.
Wow. Yeah, I hear that. And it's just overwhelming. It's just you're overwhelmed with how much bad there is. How do you dig yourself out of it? It would depend on the person, so it's hard to talk in generalities.
Right.
Because is that person victimizing themselves? Is it real? That's the first thing. Is it right. real? But it's, let's say it is. Help is the first word. You need help.
Community.
Community. A program. Maybe you need a church. Maybe you need a 12-step program. Maybe you need, you know, you need to find some help.
Right.
If you are stuck like that, you cannot get out by yourself.
Right.
Sometimes that means helping others. I mean, one of the first things you can do is find, I remember my sponsor told me, like, I was really in a bad place. My sponsor said, go to a meeting and find someone who's doing worse than you are and help them. Mm-hmm. And I did. I did go to a meeting and I called her after. I was like, nobody is doing worse than me. I couldn't find one person doing worse than me. And But, you know, just that idea that you're looking for that. And that you can all, I mean, in this world as it is. Okay, so that's one thing. Maybe that's not your, you know, listeners, I'm assuming, are listening because they're looking for help right now. So one thing is to try to help others. It's a miracle what kind of things will come from helping other people. And then breaking it down also. You cannot deal with it all at once. So, and
baby steps.
Baby steps, and also figuring out, like, what is the order of magnitude? Okay, you're having challenges, you know, in a relationship and in your income and with your housing and with your health, let's say. I can easily imagine those four things. And, you know, you're a little bit of help in one, a little bit of help in the other. You know, it doesn't, you don't need a total solution ever. Maybe in your relationship, you're going to simply separate in the same house. You're going to try to stay in your own corner for a while. Maybe you, one of you needs to go to a safer place. Maybe, you know, I think the thing that is the hardest for so many people is true loneliness. And loneliness is one of the biggest killers that we don't talk about. And it seems so silly, like, oh, you're just lonely. You know, it seems like just something you sing about in a song. But loneliness is crushing. And I would say that in most cases, for people who are overwhelmed by their problems, that the core problem is loneliness. And how do we connect? And, you know, there isn't, unfortunately, an easier answer. I mean, I know some people who are lonely who are very unpleasant people. And, you know, how do you say to someone, well, you're lonely because you're unpleasant? Nobody wants to be around you. You're not nice.
Right.
Try being nicer. I mean, I have to say a big thing. For the past 10 years, I've gotten nicer. I'm nicer to myself and I'm nicer to other people. I'm just nicer.
Was there a time when you were unpleasant to be around?
I think not generally, but sometimes.
Moments.
Yeah, I think also my tone of voice. Sometimes have been instructed that my tone of voice could put people off. And I have a tendency for a harsh tone because, like, get it done. You know, like, I like to get it done. Come on, why are you doing that? You know, I can jump there and it can be hurtful for people. So to be, what can you take responsibility for? What's one, again, to go back to what you said, which is so important, baby steps. What is one thing you could change today?
Maybe making an appointment with a psychiatrist or a therapist or
a
reaching
hotline.
Out to a
Call
friend.
A hotline.
Call a hotline.
I mean,
take a bath.
If you have a bathtub. I mean, this is going to sound stupid, but nature, I mean, try to look at a tree. You know, and talk to a tree. That is free. And the tree can receive a lot of your pain. You know, there are ways to... Here's the thing. Well, a lot of times when you're overwhelmed by all of it, you're spinning so hard. I mean, your mind doesn't even know what it is that is...
Especially if you're depressed, because difficulty making decisions is one of the hallmarks of depression.
So now you're sitting and you're spinning and you're crying and you're numb and you can't even cry. I really suggest the journal. The hand cannot move as fast as the brain. So one of the worst things when you're really suffering, and the suffering is real, is slow down your mind, write your thoughts. And it's hard because your thoughts are quite unpleasant. So you don't necessarily even want to commit them to paper all the time.
Right.
Maybe describe the room. Describe one feeling. You don't have to write it all out, but just try maybe writing down your questions. Some of the things that I told myself when it was really the worst, I came, you know, I like sometimes think of myself as a recovering know-it-all. I thought I had all the answers, and that's a hard place to be in, and it's a hard thing to think that you should have all the answers. And one of the things that we create suffering with is like this feeling of like, but I don't know. I don't know. I don't know how I'm going to get out of this. I don't even know how to get out of it. I don't even know what the problem is. I don't know. And as a quote unquote, air quotes, smart person, It was very humiliating for me to feel like I didn't even know, couldn't define the process. So sitting and writing in a journal, not ever to be read, not good writing, please just write it out. Just slow your mind down. And maybe you don't even want to hold, maybe you want to write it as a note in your phone to, you know, just in a note, a text to yourself. Just writing it down, you will slow your mind down. I used to listen to Sarah McLachlan's as a version of the St. Francis prayer when I was really suffering. I would put that song on repeat play, and that would get me through the night sometimes. And when I was really suffering, really, truly suffering. And I remember when I was really suffering, being told thoughts create feelings. And I almost hit the person that told me that. I was like, that is so obviously not true. Obviously my feelings are creating my thoughts. Obviously. And then at a certain point, when you're desperate enough, you make some changes and you experiment. I would just say experiment.
Experiment, experiment, experiment.
It's not like it doesn't have to work. Like I might tell you to journal and you might just try it and go like that 100% didn't work for me. Right. Okay. Well, what did it cost you?
Check it off the list.
Check it off the list. That doesn't work for you. Though there are very few people that doesn't help a little. Once I understood this, this is probably one of the biggest things, is that thoughts create feelings and thoughts create your life. I mean, it's the same if you talk about the First and Hope card, if you thought of, and talk about manifesting, which seems to be magic. It's not magic. It's just that your mind, the whole world is made of waves. So, you know, light and sound and color, it's all wavelengths. So your thoughts are also wavelengths. So there's not that, it's not crazy to think like your thoughts are creating your life in a way.
Right.
You know, and if you wake up every day and you think, you know, if you wake up every day and think I'm a piece of, you know, doo-doo and, you know, also this person hurt me and that person's to blame and this person's awful and I'll never and I should have and... I mean, what can come of that? What you are creating that. And so that is why, you know, people say do a gratitude list. It's not, you know, it's partly to start noticing. I would say a gratitude list would be a great thing to do also when you're suffering mightily to the person you described.
And I would also add that this does not mean this is not to be conflated with minimizing events that have happened to you.
No, not at all. Yes. Oh, thank you for saying that. You know, this is acceptance of pain experienced, understanding of pain experienced, hopefully walking towards a forgiveness of people that have hurt you. And one of the reasons why we do, you know, the so-called fourth step, but I think for everyone, you know, a list of people you've harmed and who have harmed you, is you start to understand your own part in the things that have happened.
And your patterns of thinking and acting.
You were part of everything. You were part of every single thing.
Which doesn't mean that you were to blame.
Not at all.
But you holding on to that resentment is
there
a choice.
There are things that have happened to us that, you know, they do happen to us. There are things that have happened to us that we didn't create. I mean, unless you want to go to like, you know, you chose your life path as a, you know, as a soul. That's almost irrelevant because even if you did do that, you're still here to heal it. So how do you do that? And the other thing is that, you know, life isn't fair. I mean, I think we all have a little thing in us that's like, that's not fair. When I was a camp counselor, and I still will say life isn't fair sometimes. That's not fair. You know, I think you and I even discussed some examples of that before we turned on the mics. And I was given a pie to cut for my cabin, and I sliced it up, and I tried the hardest I could try every time to make every slice exactly the same. And every single time, somebody said, I got a smaller slice, it's not fair. That summer, I was in college, I was like, oh, you know what nobody ever happens? Nobody ever says I get the bigger slice and life isn't fair. That never happened once all summer. So, you know, we only say life isn't fair when we feel we've gotten less. And that's just, it's awful to feel that you've been slighted, that, I mean, you know, I had to really come to terms, I mean, just being a woman, you know, you just go, that there's a lot of ways that's just not fair. I mean, every single day I have at least a little piece of me is like, if only I was not a woman, this would all be going differently. And then you go, I mean, one of the things is to say, I can't see the whole picture. That's a huge relief. You want to find the things to say, oh, I never completed. I'm sorry. I'm such a rambler. I never completed before. One of the things I would say to myself, recovered know-it-all, is love the question. If you can learn to love the question, does that fix anything? No. But it does take a little relief out of the area of like, I should know the answer. I'm in an awful place and I should be able to get out of it. I should have all the answers. Just for the minute, love where you are. Love the question of how am I going to get out of this? Love that you can ask that question.
Embracing not knowing can be such a revelation of freedom.
I love that word. I mean, you start to understand freedom is something of value. Courage is something of value. Integrity is something of value. Rigorous honesty is of value. You start to think, you know, when you're struggling really hard, sometimes you are desperate. And to start aligning yourself with your actual values is a relief to the heart. And as your heart heals, other things around you will begin very slowly sometimes. Very slowly. So when I say do a gratitude list, and you correctly say this doesn't mean, you know,
You're minimizing.
Yeah. I mean, when I first started doing gratitude lists, I wasn't even grateful for a lot of the biggest things. I mean, it took me, I don't know how long, but it wasn't my first gratitude list where I was like grateful for my gifts as a writer. Mm-hmm. It took a minute, you know? And when I started doing gratitude lists, I was really like, I finally had gotten to the place where I could rent a room, and it was up on Outpost. And I looked out the window the first morning I was there, and the person who I had the most resentment for, her mansion was out my window. And by the time I left, I didn't really have the resentment anymore. It can go away.
You burned her mansion down.
Yeah, well, you know, that's another show. So I guess I want to say hopefully that I've seen so many stories. One of the great things about, you know, going to, you say, a support group or meetings or being in a program or, you know, there are a lot of different ways of saying it, is you hear other people's stories and you realize it does diminish the loneliness, that you are not alone in it. Mm-hmm. And it obviously connection to a higher power, but that's sometimes hard to find when you're in your darkest place. I mean, why are you here if you have a higher power? A lot of times it's because you haven't sought that connection. So seeking you, is that
huge
word that you bring out. Seeking is such an enormous part of it. Oh my gosh. I mean, and I have to say, who are you surrounding yourself with? That's another thing to look at. You know, are the people in your life negative? I mean, if you're in that kind of place, why? I mean, it could be generational. You could have really gotten, you know, you could have been handed a whole lot of hard. Mm-hmm. And one of the other things, and I don't even know if this is true. You know, you start to say, there were some things I was like, I don't even know if that's true. But it's comforting if it is. And, you know, you can pretend. I started hanging around with somebody who really believed in God, had a lot of faith. And sometimes I just borrowed hers. I was like, I don't know. She has faith in it. Sure, let her believe in it, you know.
That's how I started. I believed that people whose lives were working, that I wanted to feel like, I believed that they believed and it was working for them.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just get next to it. Get next to the stuff you want. Get near to the stuff you want. And I also was told, I mean, I've had so much great instruction. I was also told, want what you have.
Yeah. Which is a really hard place to get to.
That's another one I wanted to hit someone when I heard that. Oh, I was like, no, 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 no. You don't understand. Hollywood. This is Hollywood. You can't just want what you have. It's L.A., you know. But the closer, now I'm on the other side of that. I'm like, well, I want what I have. And then I'm like, but you know, one thing you have is like, you need to be able to move forward in the world wanting, want what you have also includes a desire and a flame and courage to, you know, try for more.
Right.
But it means being willing to have the strength to be disappointed and being hurt and not take things personally. And
that's a really hard one, not taking things personally. Rejection is so, I mean, nothing will keep our lives small like the fear of rejection.
Yeah, it's hard.
It's really hard.
It's really hard.
And I think, you know, the one thing I hear myself responding to listeners who say, I tried therapy. My first three therapists were awful. I went to a support group. It was run by somebody who was mean or somebody hit on me or whatever.
Sure.
And I'll say, I'm sorry that that was your experience and that fucking sucks. But
there, again.
Your tribe is out there. And if you don't give up, you will find them.
Oh, yeah. You must hear so many stories, I'm sure. You know. Yeah. Well, I will second that. I mean, oh, God. I mean.
Francis Ford Coppola said, apparently when he was trying to get, I think it was The Godfather he was trying to get made, or some other movie. He said, and it got rejected at like his first 30 meetings. And somebody said, how did you keep going? He said, I knew every no brought me one step closer to a yes. Yeah. And I was like, wow.
Yeah. Well, you have to believe in your I mean, look, it was The Godfather, you know.
Right.
So that comes from making work that you have so much confidence about because you're, you know, and that it's a – if you want to come back to my book and decision making, and so you need to decide, he had decided on a project that he could have that confidence about.
Mm-hmm.
He was able to hear no because it didn't matter because it was The Godfather.
Right.
And he had a vision for it. So it's partly like, what do you decide to hitch your wagon to use an incredibly anarchistic metaphor. But, you know, if you choose projects that you believe in, well, if they're rejected, then that's just the other person's problem. You know you have the right project.
Mm-hmm.
If you just choose something that you think, well, this might sell, you know, then all right, maybe you're just going to let go of it if you hear some no's.
Mm-hmm.
But it's – so that's important too, is to keep to really try to be discerning, especially now. I mean, you have limited time here on Earth and, you know.
What'd you hear?
That we have limited time. Oh, yeah.
What do you know?
Do you what do you know? What do you hear? What do you hear? I'm in a very don't waste your time on that kind of.
And it's easier as we get older, it's
yeah.
easier to let go of. Yeah, I used to think that growing in life meant adding more skills and thoughts and stuff. And I realized the majority of my growth has been shedding things.
Mm, yeah, that's so well put. You know, the song that opens on Cabaret, which I actually wrote for 100% Happy 88% of the time, it's going to change makes us so unhappy because we cling, but we have to change to be happy. I mean, it's the essential irony. And so the letting, you know, it's like life is change. You have to change, but we cling so hard. It, to me, it's all about that, the willingness to change. Do you – and sometimes it's just that desperate. I mean, you can be grateful for your desperation. I mean, because if you are seeking right now, if you are listening to this and you are seeking, you have been given the gift of desperation.
Yeah.
And everyone doesn't have that. You can go outside right now and see sleepwalking people. And you're if you're listening to this and you're thinking, how can I change my life? How can I make it better? I'm going to give you this right now. You have the first thing is already in place, the desire for a better life. And if you have nothing else on your gratitude list, you can have that.
Mm-hmm.
The desire for a better life, the desire to be awake, the desire to be healthy, the desire to be sane. Those things are things to be grateful for, that desire. And you can feed that desire by action. You know, you can have uplifting, you know, what are you putting in? That's another thing to look at when you're in a very bad place. Or are you scrolling? I mean, look, it's important to know what's happening in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're in a very desperate place, the place you, Paul, described, You don't have room for very much news. I can tell you that.
Yeah.
You don't have room to take in 20 minutes, an hour. I mean, 1 minute or none minutes. You can pray for the people of Ukraine without taking in every detail. You knowing every detail of what's happening is not going to change the situation. Yes, we're responsible for being witnesses. Yes, we're responsible for being citizens. But your first responsibility is to be a healthy, productive, non-violent, you don't want to cause more pain. And you being in pain, we are all so connected. I think this was a very motivating factor for me in my healing. I learned that your own unhappiness, is like six degrees of separation. Kevin Bacon is unhappy if you're unhappy, is what I'm saying. It's so big. Your own happiness, and I mean, happiness is such a hard word. So, fill in your
peace.
Your peacefulness. And peacefulness is a complicated word, too. People think it means placidness. I saw a sign in my neighbor's window the other day that said, peace is a verb. I love that. I've heard God is a verb and love is a verb. I've never heard about peace as a verb, which I think really flips it because it means it's an active thing. You are behaving. You aren't peaceful. You are acting peace. Mm-hmm. So how do you share food? How do you walk? How do you talk? How do you go to the supermarket? How do you drive? All those things. So
I'm sure you've heard the Gandhi quote, there is no path to peace. Peace is the path.
Okay, yeah. But this is even a little more, peace is the walk on the path. You know what I mean? Peace is the path almost sounds like, not to contradict Gandhi, that would be very presumptuous.
Late. You already did. The emails have poured in. We haven't even released this and I've got a stack of emails.
But it's the walk. So yeah, so I would say, sometimes the first step in healing is to even feel you're worth it, It's very humbling and humiliating to be in a quote-unquote bad place. So, to feel like, to feel like you're not doing it even for yourself. I mean, sometimes it can be liberating if you're a person who is a giver. There are sometimes you find yourself in this position, you have given, you've been a nice person, you've done all these amazing things, and even so, your life is in a bad place. You might have been overgiving, you might have been giving to, but knowing that you're healing and you're radiant well-being, let's call it that, your radiant well-being is emanating out so that you can help, that you are moving the project forward. So, that can help people to feel like it's not selfish to get better.
Yeah. I mean, we do cause ripples, positive or negative or somewhere in between.
Yeah.
That is, we are, as corny as it sounds, we are all connected on some level.
And it's the biggest cosmic thing that's happening. To me, every story is that. Either we're going to get that we're connected. I mean, environmental issues, it's all about denying connection, obviously. I mean, every issue. A virus is like, I feel like everything that happens to, in quotes again, us, is a spiritual teaching. It's like, what is COVID? It's a spiritual teaching that the whole world is connected. Time after time, we keep getting these lessons. Paul? Are we going to learn it? Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's hard to watch this happen in the world.
It is.
But your mental health your mental health is your emotional health. To just go back to your mind and your feeling being connected.
Yeah.
Think differently. That's one thing you can is always in your power.
Mm-hmm. Well, Beth, thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you for having me. What a delight
really,
to talk to you.
What a great conversation. And if people want to hear your audio book, it's called So You Need to Decide.
Yes.
And website?
My website is BethLapides.com, BethLapides. And the links to the book are there. The book is everywhere. Audiobooks are Amazon, Audible, et cetera, et cetera. At the library also. And my website, and that's got stuff about UNCAB as well. And I'm on socials. On Instagram, there's a underscore between Beth and Lapides. That was a bad decision, Paul, that I regret every day.
You're going to need to do some spiritual work around that.
I need to do some spiritual work on the underscore. And yeah, I love that this podcast is such an amazing project. And thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks.
Many thanks to Beth. Be sure to check all of her stuff out, including her book. And we'll have links to that under the show notes for this episode.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Let's dive into some surveys. This is from the Shame and Secret survey filled out by a woman who calls herself Drama Mama. She identifies as straight. She's in her 50s, says she was raised in a pretty dysfunctional environment. Never been sexually abused. Not sure if she's been physically or emotionally abused. Darkest thoughts. I am sometimes glad that my husband passed away. I sometimes feel that I contributed to his death, although I understand in my brain that that is not true. Darkest secrets. I've had extramarital affairs. I hide this because of what others may think, but I do not wish that I had made other choices. Sexual fantasy is most powerful to you. It's not really a fantasy, but I wish that I could find a man that is geographically very, very far away so that we have infrequent and sex-based encounters with little to no potential for changing our circumstances. What, if anything, would you like to say to someone you haven't been able to? I wish you would include me and talk to me as you talk to others. I am in a group of friends where I am often overlooked. It puts me in a position of either insinuating myself or allowing myself to be ignored. What, if anything, do you wish for? I wish for one or two really close friends that are my emergency contacts and who I am the emergency contact for as well. I wish for people to call to just talk to me because they want to. I wish to call people freely without worrying that I'm bothering them. Have you shared these things with others? Sort of in therapy. I sometimes believe that people really like me, but it's very slippery for me to hang on to that. How do you feel after writing these things down? I feel kind of exposed and also worried that even in this forum, there will be a judgment of some kind. No judgment at all. I think what you're experiencing is really human, and I think it speaks to how terrifying intimacy can be. Because people are fucking complicated and people are gonna disappoint us. And I'm sure you had experiences in your past that were not ideal and not positively reinforcing. So, if intimacy is something that you're craving, it might be good to get back into therapy or find a support group. Just my two cents. This is from the Voice in Your Head survey filled out by a guy who calls himself Odd Man, and he writes, I'm 39 and I've never learned to drive. I've started to realize that I need a car if I'm ever going to get myself out of the service industry. My anxiety about learning to drive makes me think about killing myself. I don't know if I'll ever get my license, and I look out my apartment window at a world filled with cars and wonder why I can't be like everyone else. Thank you for sharing that. I do know some people that don't drive, and I don't know, maybe if it is something that you want to do, but there's some type of hurdle blocking you, maybe think about little baby steps and working towards that. I don't know what that would look like, but I know for me, when things seem insurmountable, if I just take little baby steps towards it, it either helps get the ball rolling. At the very least, I get more information about why I'm feeling stuck. But There you have it. This is from the Shame and Secret survey filled out by a woman who calls herself not a victim. She identifies as bisexual. She is in her 20s, says that she was raised in a slightly dysfunctional environment. She says, I lived with my grandparents and my grandmother would regularly scream abuse at my grandfather. I think my issues in dealing with my anger and also my aversion to conflict might stem from this. She's been a victim of sexual abuse and never reported it. I was raped by my boyfriend. It wasn't forceful, but it still felt violent. I didn't want to, but he's so persistent that I just gave up and relented. It took me so long to call it for what it was, sexual assault. I didn't want to report it because I don't want to have to go through the trauma again and have to deal with people telling me that spousal rape isn't a thing. It is a thing. I live with it every damn day. She's been emotionally abused. I was gaslighted, made to feel like I was wrong or stupid. I was also financially abused, all by my spouse. Any positive experiences? We were together 8 years. Not all of those were bad. Darkest thoughts. I want my current boyfriend to be rough with me, and it makes me feel like a hypocrite. You are not a hypocrite for wanting that. There's a huge difference between roughness being forced upon you without your consent and you agreeing with boundaries to engage in something with someone that you trust. Huge difference. Darkest secrets. I had planned to gas myself in my boyfriend's car. Only issue is I didn't have any money to buy the hose as he had my bank cards. Oh, that is awful. Some sexual fantasies, most powerful to you, being dominated and powerless. What, if anything, do you wish for? I want to not have flashbacks of my assault. Have you shared these things with others? I shared with my current boyfriend. He hugged me tight. It felt good. I should really go get some therapy. How do you feel after writing these things down? I want to cry, but it feels good to share. And I want to fucking high-five you for digging deep and sharing all of that stuff. It's so hard to dig that stuff up, but it's so helpful, man. It's just like poison sitting in us, just eating away. This is from the love survey filled out by Connor. And Connor writes, I love when it's finally springtime and I can open windows in my house and smell the outdoorness imprint it smells in my sheets. I love when the show I'm watching, currently Breaking Bad, has extremely short intros that I don't even need to skip. Yes, absolutely. And I love my 2-hour drive from college each weekend to my hometown, the perfect time to recollect my thoughts over the week and finally question, why am I spending this much money on gas every weekend? Thank you for those. This is from the body shame survey filled out by a woman who calls herself Furiosa. And to the question, what do you like or dislike about your body and why? She writes, I'm 5'8", 33 years old, and in my early to mid-20s, with my workout addiction, I weighed 115 to 120 pounds. Due to depression, I now weigh 183 pounds. But being in a codependent marriage where my husband works from home due to COVID and being a stay-at-home mom to a toddler, I can't be at the gym for 3 to 5 hours every day. I also can't starve myself like I used to. Growing up an athlete, I was told I wasn't allowed to be fat. Now I am, and I hate my body. Going on a sex kink website, I've used old pics of me like an idiot. I hate that my thighs touch. I have a belly and my double D boobs. It's horrible. I'd rather be sick in my addiction and be that curvy stick than this. Thank you for sharing that. And that sounds like a real fucking battle royale going on in your heads. Sending you some love. This is from the Shame and Secret survey filled out by a guy who calls himself Tibble Tobble Wobble Bobble. I'm going to assume that's his legal name. He identifies as straight. He's in his 40s, says that he was raised in a stable and safe environment. Ever been the victim of sexual abuse? Yes, and I never reported it. I had two housemates some years ago. They were a couple. We would party quite a bit. One drunken evening, I ventured off to bed. The female housemate came into my room and invited me to join them in bed. I wasn't interested. She begged and pleaded for what seemed like 15 minutes or so. She finally left. I got up and stumbled over and attempted to lock my door. I failed, however, as she came back in 10 minutes later and asked me to join them again. Again, I said no. Now she asked if she could give me a blowjob. I said no. She proceeded to pull my underwear down. I asked her to please stop, but she wouldn't. She started giving me a blowjob anyway. Though being very intoxicated, not to mention uninterested, I wasn't exactly standing at attention. I repeatedly asked her to stop. Being drunk, it was about all I could do. Plus, this person I thought was my friend. What would I have to do to physically make her stop? I didn't know what to do. Fortunately, she finally gave up and left me alone. The next several weeks were very awkward. I largely avoided her around the house. I have no idea if she even realized what she had done was highly upsetting to me. She certainly never let on that she had any guilt or remorse. I'm so sorry you experienced that. And it can be so hard for men to give weight when that happens, because the general public will often look at it like it's a wrestling match and it's all about muscle and it's not about mental or emotional coercion or manipulation. He's been physically and emotionally abused. He was married for 9 years to a very volatile woman. One time she grabbed a kitchen knife, pointed it at me, and started walking towards me. She later claimed she thought I was going to attack her and it was for protection. What the fuck? I had no history of ever being violent or attacking anyone. She'd rationalize all her behaviors like this. She ended up having an affair and later told me it wasn't cheating because I had abandoned her already anyway. She then got pregnant from this guy and asked if I would take her to get an abortion. I refused, obviously. We were officially split up at that point, but she had no job and I didn't have the heart to kick her out. I should have just kicked her out or moved out myself long before that. You live and learn. Oh, speaking of that, I posted a new survey on our website. I think the link should be up there in the next 24 hours or so if it's not. And it's about, it was a suggestion from a listener to have a survey about moments of recovery or growing or healing, you know, epiphanies, any kind of positive signs that we're getting better or moving forward. Darkest thoughts. For the last year or so, I've been in a pretty big depression. Today, for example, I stayed home from work, quote, sick. I'm just laying in bed. The depression was triggered by the breakup with the only relationship I've had since being married. It was a long-distance relationship, and she called it off as she decided she couldn't move, and I can't move either. I still love and miss her. I've tried dating, but I can't find anyone interesting or romantically interesting anyway. Most of my closest friends have moved away for work in the last 3 years. I feel like I'm destined to be alone. I'm not suicidal per se, but I do think about dying a lot. I think about various ways in which I might die. Hopefully nothing painful. I cry quite a bit. Darkest secrets. When I was around maybe 10, me and a male friend went through a period for a couple of months where we would lay together naked. I think back and I don't even know why. I guess we were exploring our sexuality. Once or twice we'd mimic sex acts, but I don't even think we were getting erections at that point. Certainly no orgasm. Once, because we thought it was funny, we were strange kids, I guess, we were with a couple of other friends and we were like, look, and we showed them quite literally what a blowjob was. I don't even know how we knew this at 10 or 11, and I don't know what it was all about. I'm straight, never had any interest in guys apart from this short prepubescent experiment. And I wouldn't even say that it was out of an interest in males. I think I was just interested in sexuality and gender didn't matter at that point. Sexual fantasies most powerful to you. I don't have any powerful fantasies. I suppose I'm fairly vanilla when it comes to sex. I tried anal for the first time in my life with my last girlfriend and quite enjoyed it. I'd like to explore that more and more, and make more use of toys.
Anal, sweet, sweet anal. It's like a flume right but in your keister.
Well, Thank you for that information, Siri. What, if anything, would you like to say to someone you haven't been able to? To my ex, it's been over a year, but I miss you every day, and I still love you. Maybe someday, when life situations are more favorable, we can be together again. What, if anything, do you wish for? To never have to talk to my ex-wife again. To find a way that my ex-girlfriend and I could be together. We broke up only because of distance. We live in different countries. Have you shared these things with others? Which? The sex stuff I discussed with my ex-girlfriend. The anal was her idea, and she was open to toys. We broke up before we could explore that more.
Come to Ireland.
Siri, please.
Every year for my birthday, boyfriend asks me what I want, and I tell him in the ass. Sailor.
Jesus. Can you just be quiet for the rest of the podcast, please?
Sorry, Snowflake.
How do you feel after writing these things down? Some of it was therapeutic. The dark secret one was like running through the grocery store naked. I've never told that to anyone.
County Cork. Next to the train station. Red house. Yellow shutters.
You made that sound like the shutters were creepy.
We like to fuck in church.
That is creepy. Is there anything you'd like to share with someone who shares your thoughts or experiences? And then they I don't know why I read that. I think I'm a little thrown off by Siri. This is from the love survey filled out by Claire. And Claire writes, I love when you get the first whiff of fall or a campfire in the distance. When you see a toddler reach for their parent's hand. When I have a meaningless day showing up at the airport hours early and just enjoying the anticipation of going somewhere. And when your therapy session falls on a day when you really need it. Oh, those are great. I love the feeling when you get through security at the airport. I don't know why I'm so anxious about the trip to the airport and going through security. But it's like I can't relax until I'm through there. And then I celebrate by buying a $15 tiny bottle of water. And then finally, these are some more loves. And this is filled out by a person who calls himself Trying My Best. And they write, I love the feeling of watching a film or TV show that's so good, it fills you up and leaves you speechless. I love the moment when the lights go out in a movie theater when the film is about to start because that's my favorite place to be. I love when I keep a promise that I've made to myself. I love when I realize that I've just done something without a second thought that used to cause me fear and shame. I love when the air smells like autumn. I love being able to feel nostalgic for things I liked when I was younger, despite the abuse I experienced throughout my childhood. I love the feeling of release after a really good long cry. I love when my refrigerator is fully stocked with my favorite drinks. I love when I use breathing exercises to try to calm down and it actually works. And I love when something small and simple can make me say, I love being alive and really mean it. Oh, those are beautiful. Those are beautiful. Thank you so much for those. And thank you guys for listening. And those of you that filled out the surveys, thank you so much. It adds so much to this podcast. And thank you to our monthly supporters. And thank you to those people that came out to Minneapolis for the live show. It was really fun. I had a great time. And we'll be airing that probably in the next couple of months. And we're going to have the video of it for the Patreon supporters. And thank you for putting up with Siri. I appreciate it. She's turned on me. I don't know how else to put it, but she is testing my patience. You know what? Maybe this is the universe trying to help me grow.
Ick.
You know what? Fuck off. And never forget you're not alone. And thanks for listening.
Everybody I know is bizarrely beautiful.
Everybody I know is
bizarrely beautifully
fucked up in some weird way.